Disrespect welcomes Jeff Manishin, a criminal lawyer with Ross and McBride, who's had experience defending homicide defendants on legal aid. He's going to talk to us about the legal aid strike. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how are you, Jeff?
I'm good. I understand the need for the protest against legal aid. There's been a protest needed for a long time against legal aid on both sides. But you probably know more about it than I do. How long has it been since the rates went up meaningfully?
Meaningfully is a great question, Jeff, because I think in the last couple of years, they wound up being raised a couple of percentage points. I think that if you went back the last several, they may have had a total of something like 15%, but to put it in real numbers, the tariff, as I've recalled it, let's say back some years ago, was about, for a senior lawyer, over 10 years experience, was about $85 an hour. And now, several years later, they've increased, and I think it's up to $98 or $96 an hour.
Right. And the market rate for a senior lawyer?
Well, experienced lawyers will bill on an hourly rate, I'm sure, anywhere from $300, $400, even $500 an hour.
Okay.
And as well, experienced criminal lawyers will also bill, or may also bill, a counsel fee rate, which may turn out to be higher than that. It might be $3,000 or $4,000 or even $5,000 a day. Top lawyers will go even higher than that.
What's a counsel rate?
Pardon me?
What's a counsel fee rate?
Well, for legal aid, there isn't one.
Right.
They used to have one several years ago. It was $500 a day for a day in court, and if you were I think it was over 10 years experience, you'd get a 25% experience upgrade.
So it's a premium.
So it worked
premium
out to
for
be
litigation.
$625 as a counsel fee for a rate for a day in court, and a given day in court might go from 10 until 1, and then there's a lunch break, and oftentimes with a jury, they need that, and then 2:30 till, say, 4:30, something like that.
Okay.
But it's very intense work.
Yeah, for sure.
So now what happened was, several years ago, I think roughly early 90s, maybe mid-90s, they decided to change elements of the legal aid plan, which used to have block fees for certain offenses. So
you
represent
like
somebody
rate.
On a break and enter. Sorry, go ahead.
Fixed rate.
It was, well, and they're fixed rates on lots of things, but they used to have a block fee, kind of a flat rate, to do a guilty plea and everything that might have been involved in a break and enter or if we're going to do a trial. But for homicide, for murder cases, they didn't. I mean, it was hourly and it was counsel fee.
Right.
They changed everything and made it all hourly.
Oh, really?
And yeah, and so they took away the counsel fee rate.
Oh.
And what it became was, back then, it'd be, say, $85 an hour. If we do the math, and your same day in court that got you $625, effectively was reduced to, call it,
$425. Yeah.
And it wasn't because you weren't working as hard or the work was less complex.
Yeah.
It was because with a view of restructuring what they pay on the legal aid plan, it was determined that's how they were going to do it. And so it's from there that they've done the adjustments. They've never gone back to the counsel fee rate.
Really?
Well, and then the other thing they used to do, too, Jeff, was they had a feature called, it was Note A on your legal aid certificate. If you happen to get an exceptional result for a client, say you win a four-week murder trial or you get serious charges withdrawn because of a presentation you could make to the Crown or to the court, you could apply for a discretionary increase. There wouldn't be any sort of set number, but it might be a couple hundred dollars or something.
Okay.
That's gone.
Okay.
And then the other thing they changed, too, is it used to be if you did a case out of town, and I've done cases in other jurisdictions, if you were, say, driving down to Welland, fine, you could bill for that hour of travel time, and if you wanted, you know, if you could also bill for mileage.
And that's at a travel rate, though.
I think that you could bill, there may have been a slightly reduced rate, but you could still bill for your travel time.
Right.
And also, you know, look for compensation for mileage.
Right.
Gone and gone.
Okay.
You can't do that anymore. They don't pay anything for travel.
Okay. So there's a disincentive to travel and there's a disincentive to go to court.
Well, I don't know if I'd say disincentive to go to court. The way I'd phrase it in terms of disincentive to travel, I think the philosophy was, look, they're probably going to be qualified lawyers in the local jurisdiction. Why do they need to be able to fund somebody from out of town? And the concept has traditionally been the ordinary client of modest means.
Right.
It's kind of the test to say, is that what the legal aid plan would fund? And I guess their reasoning process was, the government's was, maybe the ordinary client of modest means couldn't afford to hire a lawyer from out of town.
Oh, I see.
That may be the rationale behind it. But the difficulty is, in some jurisdictions, there just aren't that many qualified lawyers to do the case.
Sure, find a criminal lawyer in Jarvis,
Well, you know, you might be into the Norfolk area, and there are certainly some, But what if they don't want to take the case? What if they're busy? What if there's a particular challenge to the case that a lawyer from Toronto or even from Hamilton might have expertise in?
Oh, yeah.
Well, you're going to wind up going to that lawyer, and that lawyer is going to be looking at a legal aid plan now, which would expect him or her to take the case and do the drive down, for example, to Simcoe for free.
Yeah, let me clarify this for a listener. There's a premium of experience or talent or ability involved in actual in-court litigation. Not every lawyer wants to do it. Not every lawyer can do it well. And there was a premium to be paid when you did it, and now there's not, right?
Well, I think the way we'd phrase it, apart from the idea of premium, because the legal aid plan was always structured, you know, based on years of experience, up to 5 years at a certain rate, 5 to 10 at another rate, over 10 another rate.
Yeah.
The way I choose to, I think, focus it is this way, Jeff. Not every lawyer is qualified to be able to represent somebody in a murder case.
Yeah.
So now your pool is going to be reduced.
Yeah.
Of the ones that are qualified, there may not be that many that are prepared to take a case on legal aid, and they don't have to.
No.
But you'd say, gee, of the ones that are qualified, that are willing to do the case for that rate, do you want to basically structure it where you're also going to ask them to drive back and forth an hour each way for free?
Yeah.
That's a lot to ask.
Yeah.
And so what's difficult is, and I appreciate what criminal lawyers do, it's a difficult time economically for everybody. But on the other hand, the plan hasn't changed for a long time. And the Criminal Lawyers Association felt, look, how do we get the message out to the government to say you just can't ignore us any longer? There have been government studies recommending increases to the legal aid tariff. One of the government studies involved long, complex trials, and the former Chief Justice of Ontario and a professor from the University of Toronto, an experienced criminal lawyer himself and a former, he was deputy AG, recommended the problem with longer trials is sometimes you have counsel that aren't that experienced that are doing them.
Okay.
And so why not ensure that experienced counsel will do them and things can move along?
Yeah.
And they recommended an increase to the legal aid tariff.
Who is the deputy AG?
Oh, it's Professor Michael Coate. He and former Chief Justice Pat Lesage were commissioned to report to the government of Ontario on issues and problems that arise from long trials.
Okay.
And they did a report, I think it was in 2008.
And it was called the...
Well, it's referred to as the Code Lesage Report.
Okay.
I forget the formal title, but it had to do with the commission inquiring into or looking into difficulties in long and complex criminal cases.
Yeah.
And that was their recommendation. And so there have been a few. So one might say that the evidence is there to support the change in the tariff. Now, the government might say, well, where can we find the money? We just don't have it.
Yeah.
So you wind up in a situation where if you went back a year or two ago, maybe times were more flush. The tariff wasn't changed then significantly. What are you going to do? What are criminal lawyers going to do at a certain stage? You say, look, how do we get the government's attention to say it really does, it is really a time for a change?
Yeah.
And not huge, but I mean, let's get a mechanism to increase it.
Yeah.
And it could phase it in a few years, but
people on fixed incomes are facing much simplified difficulties in the same vein. You know, in good times, fixed incomes were reduced, they were not increased. And now that it's hard times, they're saying, look, you know, food went up by 17% last year, our incomes went up by 2%. What are you going to do?
Sure, and you could even say this, in tougher economic times, more people need to rely upon legal aid.
Oh, absolutely.
So that's another feature. So what happened was, to give the listeners a little bit of a history, it was the Ontario Criminal Lawyers Association felt as a way of getting the government's attention to the problem they would start. It's not really, I suppose, I don't know what's right to call it a strike, but let's characterize it as a boycott for the acceptance of new legal aid certificates for murder or for attempt murder or for appeals on murder cases.
What's the philosophy?
Or the complex guns and gangs cases that there are the whole squads and teams doing investigation and prosecution on the trial.
Tell us what the philosophy is behind selecting these cases, because, I mean, there's a lot of legal aid certificate cases that aren't capital crimes.
Yeah, great question. And I think the answer to that one, Jeff, is criminal lawyers didn't want to say to the public of Ontario, look, we aren't going to do these cases only. We aren't going to take legal aid certificates. We're just going to cut you off cold.
Right.
The idea was, how can you get the message across? How can you make a statement? How can you get the government's attention in a way that we're characterizing as meaningful but moderate? So lawyers are still taking legal aid cases in a host of
other issues. Like family law and stuff, yeah.
Well, whether family law or sexual assault cases.
Oh, okay.
Impaired causing death or bodily harm.
Okay.
Fraud, robbery, break and enter.
Really?
All kinds. They're still taking the certificates for those cases.
I see.
But the idea was, let's make it focused.
Yeah.
Let's make it meaningful.
Yeah.
And they started in Toronto. And lawyers didn't have to, shall we say, sign on, but they did in substantial numbers.
Yeah.
And then when that didn't lead to any significant change, it has gradually spread to other jurisdictions. And so other cities, their local criminal law associations or local law association criminal law sections have been asked, will you participate? And lawyers have.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I gather it goes from Thunder Bay to Ottawa now.
I think that's right. And you know, we'll keep our eye open on if cities are not yet in. I expect they will be. I mean, Hamilton's one. I think Barrie is another. It's, you know, it has expanded, and I think you'd find a lot of criminal lawyers that are very supportive of it. We're deeply concerned about it, and it's the idea is, can you come up with a solution that's not simply short term? Well, we'll just do this a temporary change.
Mm-hmm.
Come up with a structure. A mechanism for reviewer, we say every year, every couple of years, it will be reviewed. You won't have to get to this problem.
Yeah.
That's the objective. And
the Rodney, the
I mean,
Rodney
we'll
Dangerfield
we'll
objective, I want some respect.
Pardon me?
The Rodney Dangerfield objective, I want some respect.
Well, you could characterize it, yeah, you could characterize it that way. I think that the work is sufficiently difficult, and the skill set is, you know, that's involved, that's required, is pretty substantial. So what do you do to have a appreciating that you want to provide a legal aid plan that's meaningful and that's important and that ensures people do get good representation and that there are qualified lawyers that are willing to take it on? Because that's been a problem over the years. Criminal lawyers have been basically ceasing doing legal aid cases.
Yeah.
And so now you say, well, okay, who's it going to be left to? The ones that are willing to continue to hang in there, go through the difficult work, or the ones who aren't as experienced, maybe not qualified?
Yeah.
So that's really what, it wasn't an approach that the Criminal Law Association did with a great, I'll characterize it as, with any level of happiness or enthusiasm. There was a measure of reluctance, a measure of, okay, we'll do this. It's not something we rush to have to do. We're used to representing people, but we've got to get this message out.
Somebody asked me recently who's not familiar with legal aid, was fortunate enough to have a lawyer work for them on consignment on occasion, and said, why would the lawyers do that? And
when you say on consignment, you mean on contingency?
Contingency, yeah.
Yeah?
And I said, well, I don't know why they would do that. I'm going to find out in the interview, but I can think of a number of reasons. One is that these are dramatic charges that are going to capture the public's imagination. If you're not defending someone who's facing perhaps life imprisonment or an organized crime-related sentence, people know these are tough sentences, and they know that people who are convicted unjustly will pay very stiff penalties for something that they didn't have to do. The other thing is, these may be more complex cases because of the stakes, and maybe the lawyers are thinking that once the courts are tied up with these complex cases and people who don't know how to handle them, maybe the government will sit back and do the math. And worst case scenario, maybe it'll occur to somebody in the government that not only are they going to spend a lot of time prosecuting these cases, they're going to spend a lot of time undoing them once they've been wrongly done, too. There's going to be a lot of appeals. There's going to be a lot of go-backs. There's going to be a lot of restitution.
Compensation, you mean, for people wrongly convicted?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know how much of that was right, but you tell me.
Well, you know, it's not an outcome that anybody from the Criminal Lawyers Association would want to see occur.
No.
And so let's go back and say, you know, why would a criminal lawyer take on a murder case?
All right.
And I think there's a few different reasons. I think that there are those who are, and many are, deeply committed to the cause of justice.
Okay.
And they want to ensure that someone gets proper representation on the principle that in our society, democratic society, people are entitled to that.
Yes.
There are people who find it fulfilling.
Mm-hmm.
They say, this is what I'm capable of doing, and this is what I love to do and live to do, and this is a great challenge for me. And it's so there's a level of satisfaction to it.
So the high stakes are a driver for them.
Well, we could say the high stakes, there's an element for some lawyers of that, the challenges that come up in those sorts of cases. For some, it may well be the variety to say, okay, I haven't had a case which involves, for example, psychiatric issues.
Okay.
You know, with a not criminally responsible mental disorder. And I really believe in ensuring that an individual who is suffering from that difficulty gets the best representation in the position, the position gets put forward fully.
Okay.
There's a whole variety of reasons. I mean, obviously, you could do the obvious one is some people would say, well, it's to make money.
Sure.
You know, you aren't going to get rich, I don't believe, on a legal aid homicide practice. Okay? Or alternatively, if you were, what kind of hours are you going to have to work? They could be extremely long.
Yeah.
That, you know, at that rate.
And
there's a risk, too, in the legal aid plan currently. You know, it does happen that you submit your account and they say, well, sorry, we aren't going to pay you for all of that.
Yeah, they have caps, don't they?
Okay, we may cap it. That's right. You've gone over the cap. Well, fine then. All you're getting is the hours we said, the hours you said you were going to do with the case in, or the hours we said you could do it. You'd have to be limited to.
Yeah.
So, you know, you wind up in a situation where you put in these extra hours, because of your commitment, your dedication, your professionalism, and you don't get paid at the end.
So the caps.
So how do you manage your office?
The caps.
How do you cover your overhead?
Issue,
pay staff. Look after bookkeeping.
Yeah.
Renting, photocopying space, all those things.
So that's issue number two in this book.
Well, it's a reality for lawyers in private practice. And remember that from the government side, they can put a couple on a guns and gangs case. They may have a team of prosecutors assigned to those.
Mm-hmm.
But it may be one defense lawyer.
Yeah.
So then you say, gee, what are potential outcomes? Well, the commission into pediatric forensic pathology chaired by Commissioner Gouge, the Justice of the Court of Appeal, expressed some concerns over the complexities of pediatric homicide cases, shaken baby syndrome and matters of that sort, and the need for proper compensation by the legal aid plan for experts that may be rehired by the defense. They actually get paid at a lower rate than the government pays experts retained by the Crown.
Yeah.
So Commissioner Gouge, in his report, and there were a number of issues of wrongful conviction there, expressed some concern over inequities in the legal aid plan, and he recommended changes.
Yeah, so it's
not that anybody wants to see the government put to the expense of compensation or people wrongly convicted or inadequately represented. Nobody on the defense bar wants to see that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the reality if lawyers won't take the cases on or if they're inadequately resourced. There is a risk of it, and that's
yeah. So, with or without the boycott, these penalties are appearing.
Well, we've had, I think, lawyers that have declined taking legal aid cases.
Yeah.
You know, legal aid homicide cases, and it's left for others to do. And it used to be 2 years back, you could even a senior lawyer could have a junior counsel work with him or her, and at a reduced rate.
Mm-hmm.
And they've cut back on that a fair amount.
Really?
Now, the old system of younger lawyers learning, working with senior lawyers, thus being able to take on a homicide case themselves, that's really diminished.
Why?
I guess it's a matter of funding.
Yeah.
But they say, no, sorry, we aren't going to authorize a junior.
Okay. Yeah.
So the whole situation, I think we could probably say, Jeff, from every standpoint, currently, is not satisfying. It's not satisfactory. It's not desirable. And it's a real problem. We're all concerned, and I include the government in that. And so the hope is that they basically take steps to say, look, where can we want to find the resources and phase it in over a period of time if necessary.
Yeah.
But offer some encouragement to say we are committed to doing something and we are doing something.
Yeah.
Not, well, it's the wrong time. Not, well, it's we're have not problems, we haven't got the funds.
We're studying it.
Yeah, or we need more reports or we need more evidence.
Yeah.
Or you know, and I think the other problem, I think, too, is it may well be, and I may be wrong on this, but the public sentiment so often these days is in favor of law and order.
Out of sight, out of mind,
Pardon me?
Out of sight, out of mind.
Well, it's a matter of saying, gee, these guys should be punished. And gee, these guys, these terrible crimes, these guys
should be
punished.
Yeah, which includes everyone who's accused as guilty by presumption.
Well, that can happen. And so
that's inherent in that attitude, though.
On the law and order emphasis. See that people are, you know, are punished, they're charged, they're prosecuted, and they're punished, and you're going to wait a sec. How about the fair trial element?
Yeah.
A presumption of innocence element.
Yeah.
The proper representation by independent counsel element.
Yeah.
I think that for those who say, gee, we've got to emphasize law and order, you'd like to be able to say to them, sure, but don't you want to ensure that the justice system works fairly and soundly and in a principled way that respects the rights of those people that are charged? They don't have the kind of resources the state does. So that's the kind of message that I try and explain to people when I get the opportunity to do so, is to just say, look, there is another perspective. Just keep it in mind.
Yeah, good. Yeah. Now, that's a very, that's an attitude that might catch, too. You know, you don't have to invalidate your point of view that you want law and order, but there is another perspective, and maybe you could think of it, too.
Sure. Well, as you raised earlier, I mean, nobody wants to see a wrongful conviction. Not only is there a fundamentally wrong aspect to a person being found guilty in jail for a crime he or she didn't commit, mm-hmm. but you get into the issue of what about the right the real perpetrator having escaped sanction?
Yeah.
And what about the cost of incarcerating somebody wrongly for many years?
Yeah.
And what about the cost of the appellate process and potential compensation at a future stage? You know, on many levels, it's really undesirable. What about the feeling of, gee, our justice system failed? How about that one?
Yeah.
How about, gee, it didn't work the way it should have?
Yeah.
Nobody wants to be, you know, I believe Canadians are principled and committed to a true democratic and just criminal justice system. And part of that involves the avoidance of wrongful conviction.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think the problem is not enough people see themselves in that box in court.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, and you see it in a variety of different ways. People they may not really have the sense of what it is like to be charged with a criminal offense.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be very stressful.
Mm-hmm.
And you have resources marshaled against you, and who do you look to for support? And sometimes the only... aside from family, the only bastion you have to stand between the power of the state and your own loss of liberty is your lawyer.
Yeah. Okay.
So it's a heavy responsibility, and I believe criminal lawyers try and live up to that in a responsible way.
I spoke to Frank Addario, the Criminal Lawyers Association, to get the referral to you, and I asked them. I tried to get a heads up on this interview, and I said, "So have you made any progress?" He says, "Oh yeah. I got a check in the mail for $120 million today." He says, "Jeff Manishin will bring you up to date."
Frank is known for his droll or dry sense of humor.
Yeah, well, I gather that whatever progress you may have made is very very subtle at this point. For lack of a better word,
I don't know that there's any real progress.
Okay,
I mean, we're in the summer.
Oh,
I don't know that the legislature is really turning their attention to it. They're certainly aware of it.
Okay.
And, in terms of the stage at which we might actually see something, I mean, sure, it'd be great to be able to see a response in the summer. But I even if it was a matter of the Attorney General being able to say, look, here's the plan we're working on right now. Here's what I can come back to you with.
Yeah.
We intend to achieve this by this level, by this date. I've got support of cabinet colleagues, for example, at this stage.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the kind of changes we're working towards making that might create some level of encouragement. But at this stage, I don't know that I could identify anything in the way of progress. But then I'm not part of the Criminal Law Association executive, so Frank would be in a better position to tell you than me.
If he thinks you could bring me up to date, what you know is probably pretty much what he knows.
Yeah, I think when Frank talked about the check in the mail,
oh, I know.
As I say, Frank and I go back a long ways.
Yeah.
And, sometimes I have to watch myself. What? Did you really mean that, Frank? Okay. Because sometimes he'll say something in a deadpan way that's funny.
Well,
I would tell you this.
He picked a figure out of thin air, obviously.
Yeah, oh, sure. I would tell you this on this issue, Frank and the Criminal Lawyers Association executive, I think are generally felt amongst our membership is showing really strong leadership.
Good.
Remember, Frank has his own practice to manage.
Okay.
It's not like we have him on salary to be our president for the year.
But he doesn't
He has a practice to run in addition to being the president, and that means being available for all kinds of media interviews. And it isn't only on the legal aid issue.
Okay.
You may have seen the other day when there were issues, there were decisions by the Supreme Court of Canada on interpretations of the Charter of Rights.
Mm-hmm.
Frank was quoted in relation to that.
Yeah.
When the government proposes tougher law and order-based statutory minimum sentences for more crimes sentencing options, Frank may well be interviewed on that. So I think what he likes to be able to do is when you have people in local communities who can articulate the positions on behalf of the association, I'm sure he's happy to delegate it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've talked about this issue before, and
yeah.
if there's a listener who hasn't yet heard how the analysis of the issues goes, well, then that's what I'd like to be able to share.
I think you have. Is there anything else that you would like to say that we haven't touched on?
No, I appreciate Jeff having the opportunity to explain the issues this way. You try and do it in a fair and balanced way, and you try and ensure that people understand it's not simply a matter of, oh, Laura's want more money. Something else. No, but there are people that will react that way.
I know.
Without considering the entire picture.
Yeah.
Whenever I've had the opportunity to do any media commentary, whether it's TV or radio, it regularly happens. People come up to me later saying, I understand the issues better. Thanks for explaining them.
Yeah.
I didn't understand it the way that you... Before you explained it, I didn't understand it that way. I didn't have the full picture. And now I do, and thanks for doing that. I don't mind. I think that that's the kind of responsibility lawyers have.
Okay.
And on issues of law, but also on issues of, you could call it, social policy. And in this particular case, on issues of justice, access to justice, and why we're taking a particular position that might on the face of it seem to be unreasonable, the opportunity to be able to say, here's why we're doing it, I hope you can understand it and appreciate it and potentially support it and maybe even talk to your members of the provincial legislature and say, look, you guys should do something about it. I understand the issue. I'm not going to be silent. I do feel strongly enough that I can make the phone call, send an email.
Yeah.
That's as much as I can ask.
Well, you have not to be hard-edged about it, but you have a two-year run-up to the next provincial election, and I think that's in your favor, too.
Well, we'll see. I mean, you know, I've said in the past sometimes, Jeff, the problem with politics is it's too political. You know, you'd like to feel that...
I'll make that a slogan for the show.
Oh, yeah. You'd like to feel that politicians aren't driven just by what does it take to get reelected. They're really committed to what's best for my community,
yeah,
locally, regionally, and provincially.
Yeah.
What's best for with the weighty responsibilities I have in office of balancing a variety of interests.
Yeah.
And if it turns out I don't get reelected, well, I did the job the way I believe I should do the job.
Yeah.
That's really what you'd like to see from politicians, and I'll continue to hope that that'll be the approach that'll be followed here, and that they will realize how difficult the situation we face at the present time with the legal aid plan, and they have the studies that really give all the rationale behind the change. So it just becomes now a matter of saying, okay, we've got to do something.
Well, they're deep into their second term, so their pensions are secure, and maybe they can turn their attention to the priorities.
I don't know if provincial politicians get pensions.
No,
that's an area outside of my expertise.
Okay. Well, I just hope that that they've been at this long enough now to understand the importance of what you've told us today. Thanks very much.
My pleasure, Jeff.
All right, thanks, Jeff.
Okay, bye.